Good morning, Sri Annai, Bhagavan Sri Aravindar, Tavatiru Appa Karmayogi avargalin paadaravindangalil paninde indaya nigaichiyai thuvangugirom. Indu Life Divine Web Meeting nigaichi, Mr. Gary Jacobs avargal, Brahma, Purusha, Ishvara, Maya, Prakriti, Shakti endra thalaippil Part 2 pesa irukkirargal. I am inviting Mr. Gary Jacobs to start the meeting.
Good morning. Today we'll try to complete the second chapter of Book 2, Part 1. This chapter is a summary of the whole life divine. If we get everything that he's trying to tell us in this chapter, there's not much that's left unsaid. He's asking a fundamental question, which we all ask at some time in our life, probably not in a philosophical sense, but in a practical sense. Why are things happening? Why are things the way they are? Why am I the way I am? Why is life the way it is? Why is the world the way it is? Who or what is really determining things? Sometimes we feel like we're helpless, little specks on a wave of an ocean, just being pushed around and dragged one way or another. Yet at other times, we feel everything depends on us. If I don't prepare the meal, there'll be no meal tomorrow. If I don't keep my children in check or see that they do their homework, they'll fail. Most often this comes with regard to ourselves. If I don't take care of myself, who will? What is the truth? How is the world really governed? What is the role? What is my role? What is your role as an individual? What is the role of karma, of life, of fate, of nature, natural law, of God? Where does God fit into this whole thing? We normally think of God in emergencies. Most of the time, we take care of ourselves, or we expect other people to take care of us, or we rely on our family, rely on our society. It's only in the real emergencies that we think I need a little extra help here. So maybe God's the court of last appeal. When we can't do it for ourselves and nobody will do it for us, we think of God. Is that really the role of the divine in the world? But if we think about it a little more carefully, we see that nothing we have, nothing we know, nothing we do really starts from us. Left to ourselves, we are zero. What do we know that we haven't learned from our family? What do we possess that would have been possible for us if we didn't have family, community, and society? If we really look at everything we have, everything we know, everything we are, we might come to the conclusion that our society is God, that society is the mother, who gives us everything. I don't know about you, but I don't know how to grow cotton. I don't know how to convert it into yarn. I don't know how to weave it into cloth. Left to myself, I would have no clothes. I don't know how to grow paddy or wheat, convert it into bread. Of course, some of you know how to do that. I don't know how to produce the oils or raise the cows or produce the foods we have or harvest the lumber or make the bricks or the cement to have a house. Left to myself, I would have no clothes, I would have no food, I would have no house. Where's the question of knowledge? Where did we get the knowledge that we have? Oh, some of us pride ourselves. I know cooking very well, or I know driving very well. Where did we learn that? How did we acquire that? How do we know which foods are edible and which things are not edible? How do we know how much salt or sugar or anything to put in anything? It's all been taught to us. It's all been learned over thousands of years by our forefathers. Tens of thousands of years. Which plants are helpful? Which plants are harmful? Who invented the pillow and the mattress and the fan and the AC? We have no idea. All the knowledge we have, all the knowledge our children have, has been accumulated over thousands of years by society. And what is it? It's given to us free. Nobody says you have to, you cannot wear clothes because somebody else invented clothes. Everything we have has been given to us, let alone the roads that we drive on and the electricity that's there and the television and the newspapers and everything. We're constantly thinking, everything's not all right, I need a little more. We rarely stop to think of what we have. And if that were taken away, we won't be thinking about the little more. I need a little bigger house, or I need a new watch or something like that. My child needs a better admission or a good score. Your child has a school. There are schools and colleges available. And there's knowledge to be taught. And there's internet and books to be available to us. We think about the little tiny bit of all that we received and all that we live on, which comes to us from our family, from our community. We're proud of the community we come from and the skills it has taught us and the values it's taught us, the culture it's given us, the music it's given us, the traditions it's given us. But what is this community? What is this society? If we look a little further, we see this society. The society is not just a bunch of people. It's indescribable. We know it's there, but it's indescribable. It's the mother of everything we have. But then if we look a little farther, we see, really, the society is nothing without life. It's life that makes possible the society. Where would we be if life did not create all of the species of plants and animals, that life did not give the sunshine and the fresh air that we breathe? There are about 300,000 varieties of flowers in the world. Society may help us get them. We don't grow all the flowers. Some of you may be fortunate too. We don't all grow the flowers ourselves. We get them. We get them in the market from others. But where did the flowers come from? Life has given us so many varieties of flowers. Where would we be without life? Where would society be? No society could be there for a moment without the supporting life. And where does life get its abundance? Where does life get its infinite creativity? What makes life the way it is? Why is the atmosphere of Earth filled with oxygen and not just filled with gases that we can't breathe? When we go on asking these questions, we keep going further and further and find that actually what we do for ourselves is almost nothing. What we've acquired for ourselves is less than nothing. All has been given to us by our family, by our society, by life, and by something beyond. And what do these have to do with each other? Well, when we look this way, we have to reverse our view. Because our normal view is, I have to take care of myself. I have to do everything for myself. Everything depends on me. But when we look at it from this perspective, we see almost everything depends on something else. Our role in it is very little. Our role in it is important. But what does this have to do with that? What does my action have to do with what my family has done, my society has done, life has done, or that greater eternal reality has done, which we call God or Brahman or the Absolute? And he tells us, if we want to go to the foundation of everything, the basis for everything, the real reality on which we exist, it is a supreme, absolute, eternal, infinite reality which is indescribable. There is no word for it. And yet, at the same time, it is the basis of everything. It is everything we know. The real reality that we call divine, spirit, Brahman, God, or any other name, is not something far off. It's everything here now. It's the omnipresent reality. So if we really want to understand how the world is governed and how our lives is, we have to understand how that supreme absolute reality manifests itself to create a world, to create life, to create human consciousness, to create society and family and community and individuality, and to create us. Our soul, our being, our personality. And we ultimately have to understand, what is our relation with that? Are all these things different? Are we different from our family? Are we different from our community? Are we different from the society? Are we different from life? Are we different from the divine? Or are they all different expressions of one reality? And he tells us in this chapter, there is only one reality. There is only one fundamental existence. And all of these expressions, including all of us, are expressions of that. Well, this doesn't seem to clear things up very much, because now instead of having one divine that's determining everything, we seem to have millions of forms and types and varieties and of the creation of the divine influencing what happens. So how does it really work? What is really governing the way the world works? The divine is the transcendent absolute. The divine is the cosmos. The divine is all of us. And he tells us in this chapter, and we discussed it last time, that divine takes three aspects. And those three aspects have three powers of consciousness by which they work in the world. And it is the action of those three aspects and those three powers of consciousness that determines everything that is and everything that we are. And he says that this world is an expression of real truths. It's not just a mistake. It's not just an imagination. It's not an illusion. But everything that is here are expressions of fundamental truths that are there in the absolute. And in this chapter, he explains to us how those truths of the absolute express in the world we live in and govern the world we live in. But in order to understand this, he tells us, we have to avoid a fundamental mistake, the fundamental mistake of mind, that we tend to divide things and into opposites and try to understand things in terms of opposites. And the whole key of understanding the divine governance of the world is to know that what we see are opposites are really complements, are complementary aspects of a greater truth. And we discussed last time, and it discussed in this chapter, for us, the unmanifest and the manifestation are two different things. But he tells us the manifestation is an expression of all that is unmanifest. For us, the finite and the infinite are opposites. But he tells us all that is there as finite is only a frontal appearance of the infinite. Behind every finite, the infinite is there. The infinite is everywhere, at every moment, in everything. It is the infinite that becomes the finite. It is the formless that becomes all form. And if it wasn't formless, it couldn't become all form. We have gold jewelry and gold spoons and gold vessels and gold statues and so many things. Gold can become all of those things because gold itself has no form. Gold is the substance that takes form. And all the action in the universe, all the dynamics of the universe, he tells us, is an expression of a status that's immobile. All the action in the universe, all the movement in the universe, all the events in the movement come from something which never moves and never changes. It is the immobile status of the absolute, the supreme, unmanifest, the transcendent. So in our trying to understand the governance of the universe, we have to constantly remind ourselves that the things we think are opposite are not opposites at all. They're two expressions of some greater reality, which is a mystery to us. And we also discussed last time that this infinite manifests itself in the world through three powers. A power of self-determination. By a power of self-determination, the infinite decides to become many things. It can become anything. It becomes everything. And by a power of self-limitation, the infinite can decide to limit itself to be a particular thing and express a particular thing and conceal or hide all the rest of its infinity behind. And this power of self-limitation is the source of our individuality. If it wasn't for the fact that the infinite has a power of self-limitation, we couldn't all be sitting here and feeling like we're different people, individual people. Each of us is a unique manifestation of the infinite that's decided to limit itself in each so that it can infinitely vary in all. And then we discussed last time that it has a third power. It has a power of self-absorption. It has the power to hide from itself, to conceal itself, to forget itself. And now we can understand that very well, because all of us, almost all the time, forget that we are absolute, that we are infinite, that we are eternal, that all others are one with us and we are one with the divine. Because of this third power of self-absorption, which is the source of the ignorance in the world and the ignorance we live in. And he's going to tell us in the next chapters, this whole 14 chapters is about the ignorance and why it exists. He's going to tell us the ignorance is the greatest mystery and the greatest marvel, the greatest wonder, and the greatest power for the divine creation. He's most proud of his invention is the ignorance, without which all the multiplicity and all the wonders and delights of the evolution would not be possible. So the divine has three fundamental powers by which it can be multiple things. It can limit itself to each of those things, at least in appearance. And it can forget itself or conceal its knowledge of itself in self-absorption to come to us. We are varied from each other. We are individual from each other, and we're ignorant. These are the basic concepts we discussed last month in the first part of this chapter. And he tells us, now we're going to discuss, what are these three aspects of the existence and these three powers of these aspects? That's the chapter, title of this chapter, Brahman, Purusha, Ishwara, Maya, Prakriti, Shakti. What is this formula? This is the formula for the whole universe, for the whole manifestation, for all we can know and discover about the divine. Why these three aspects are there? Why they're necessary? What are their roles? What's the difference between them? What's the commonality between them? I find it easiest to think about it if we think about Jane Austen. Jane Austen can take several poises, as all of us can. Jane Austen, we know Jane Austen as the author of Pride and Prejudice. But that's not all Jane Austen is. She's not just an author. She was a daughter, she was a sister, she was a friend. She was a citizen. She may have been many other things. And all those things don't describe who Jane Austen is. She's something beyond that. She's a person. She's a soul. She's a being. Unrelated to the story that she's written, She has a whole existence beyond the story. And the divine has a whole existence beyond the world. The divine is not limited to the world anymore and the universe any more than Jane Austen's limited to her story. And we can try to know that divine just the way we could try to know Jane Austen if we could meet her and live with her and explore her other facets of her life. We would maybe forget after a time that she's even a writer because we'd be so lost in her other wonders. And we can try to discover those other aspects of the divine, other than the ones that we're concerned with every day, is God going to give us everything we want in our lives? And that experience of that aspect is the experience of the self, Atman, the silent self, the immobile self. This is the divine beyond the world, the divine that's not just concerned with us and creation, which we think is so important to us. Because we can't limit the divine to creating this universe or a million universes. The absolute, the Brahman, is beyond, exceeds all its creation. And this is the first of its aspects, which if we want to know the truth of our own existence, and the truth of the universe, we have to discover the self, the Atman. Because when we do that, we discover not only that the divine exists beyond the universe, that he's got other things, that he's more than just the one who's helping us out here, but we exist beyond the universe too. We are infinite. We, each of us, is eternal because we are not just a being here in a body. We are not just living in this world. We're not just taking birth. We have an eternal portion of ourselves, which is also infinite and eternal. The self of ourselves is that Atman. We are part of that. It's not like he's just leaving us down here. We exist eternally also. So he tells us in this chapter, one of the most important things we can do if we want to gain our spiritual fulfillment, if we want to play our true role in the universe, in our evolution, is we must know we're more than this. We're not only more than the body. We're not only more than our vital and our mind. We're not only more than this birth or a succession of births. We are also infinite and eternal self. That self is our self. And secondly, we have to discover that portion of the divine which is concerned with the world. And there is an aspect of the divine that's the witnessing all that happens in the world, enjoying all that happens in the world, supporting all that happens in the world. And nothing can happen in the world without its sanction. And this is what in the tradition is called Purusha. And in English, he uses the term conscious being. There is a being, a conscious being, if you wish, a person, beyond the universe, beyond all universes, that sees all, watches all, witnesses all, experiences all, sanctions all, and without that person and that sanction, nothing could be. Nothing could exist. This is the Purusha. And that person is also us. We are that person. So there's a self, which is Jane, the rest of Jane Austen's life. There's also a part of Jane Austen that, like us, She can think of the story. She can read the story. She can watch the story. She can enjoy the story. She can witness the story. But there's another part of Jane Austen's personality. She's the creator. She creates the story. And everything in the story is what has created by her. And nothing happens in this story that isn't determined by Jane Austen. She's the Ishwara who creates all. And ultimately, if we want to know the truth of ourselves and the truth of the divine, it's not enough that we know that we have an eternal, immortal, infinite self. It's not enough to know that there's a part of us or a real truth of us that's beyond all this worldly cares and is just watching everything and enjoying it. We must also know that we are a portion of Ishwara. We are a portion of the Lord of existence that determines everything. We create the way Jane Austen creates. And our destiny, the whole purpose of this whole thing is, ultimately we should discover in each of ourselves that we are the Ishwara. And we have come, we have taken birth, we have evolved as a soul, developed our psychic being, developed our personalities, in order to allow the Ishwara in us to create. And when we do that, what we will have is not one God supervising and pulling the strings of all us puppets down there, but the ultimate divine life will be each of us knows we are the divine. We are the Ishwara. And whatever we will becomes reality. And hopefully by the time we get there, we'll be a little more mature than Mrs. Bennett, and we won't be willing that to triumph over Lady Lucas or to prove that we're better than everybody else, because at that point when we know we are the Ishwara, we will also know something else. We will also know that everybody else is the Ishwara. We will all know that we are parts and expressions of the one infinite being that has become this world, become this reality for the joy of being multiple, for the joy of experiencing. And because it's infinite, it can't express itself through one of us or two of us. It has to express itself through an infinite number of itself, its own selves. No author, no matter how creative they are, can write all the things that can be written. We need millions of authors to write. Like that, we need millions of creators to really express the infinity of the Creator. So in this chapter, he's telling us that we are the Self. We are the Purusha. We are the Ishwara. We are the individual expression of them. But they're not limited to being in us. The whole cosmos, there is a cosmic self. There is a cosmic being. There is a Lord of the cosmos. And beyond that, there is a transcendent self, a transcendent being, the transcendent creator of all cosmoses. And these three are not different from one another. They are all aspects of the one reality. So we've got three aspects expressing in three levels, individually, in the cosmos, and in the transcendent. If this is getting confusion, we can simplify the whole thing and remind ourselves that ultimately there's only one. One reality that's expressing through three powers in different aspects at different levels of individual, cosmic, and transcendent. But there's more to it. Because each of these three aspects has a power or a characteristic action. And that's what he refers to as Maya, Prakriti, Shakti. When we come to life, we don't experience the divine, we don't experience ourselves as the creator all the time, and we don't experience the divine acting all the time either. For us, the idea that Mother responds to us, grace is a rare exception or an infrequent occurrence. We may tell ourselves everything is grace, but when the coffee spills or we get caught in the rush hour traffic, or the internet doesn't work, or our spouse forgets to call us on the phone, or if we forget something when we go shopping, or whatever else happens, or our child doesn't do well in the exam, we don't first thing think of the grace that's acting at this point. Something else seems to be acting here. And if I walk across the room in a clumsy way and I trip and I hurt myself, we don't think it's grace. There's something else going on here. And if I fall and I fall in a pit, it's heavy, and the further I fall, the heavier the fall is, we think, yes, gravity has done that. We don't think grace has made it like that. So we have to not only understand the pure existence, but we have to understand the powers by which these three aspects work. And this is where we get confused easily. Because when we look at life, it's not very simple. If things were really clear-cut, we would know that God's doing everything. It's not very clear. Sometimes we think it's our neighbor that's the cause of the problem, or our husband that's the cause of the problem, or our wife who forgot to put the sugar or the salt in the food is the cause of the problem. We don't see God acting everywhere. Huh? And where does this ignorance come from? We got another God here. We've got God and an ignorance. Ultimately, we have to understand the relationship between God and the ignorance. Sometimes things don't seem to make sense at all. We don't know why they happen. We don't know even though why we do things sometimes. I don't know why I said that. I don't know what got into my head. We often feel we don't know why other people say what they have said or do what they do. In fact, often other people are really a mystery to us. And there are certain things in our life that are absolutely predictable. 9:30 on a Monday morning when you go out in the traffic, it's going to take 45 minutes to go down on us alive because of the rush hour traffic, because everybody's going, no, it's going to be like that. If you start the car and you don't have any petrol in it, you know it's not going to start. You expect it's not going to start. During the power cut, the TV won't work. The lights won't work unless you have an inverter. There are so many things that seem to be predictable to us. They seem to be by law. If you don't eat for 3 days, you're going to be very hungry. And if you don't sleep for 3 days, you're going to be very tired. We know the rules. There's a certain amount of water we have to drink. There's a certain amount of air we have to breathe. Otherwise, things don't work. You can't make the Italy, I suppose, without the cram. I don't know. Is that still Italy? So there seem to be laws, rules, whoever makes them, that govern a lot of what's going on. In some areas, we're in charge. I can decide what I want for dinner tonight, hopefully. If I'm cooking, I can decide, or if my wife obliges me, I can decide within limits. In some areas, we seem to be in charge. In some areas, there seem to be rules and laws that govern everything. In other areas, we don't know what's governing anything. And these are our common experiences in life. And when we don't know why anything happens, we can say it's Maya. It doesn't make any sense. It's just chance. It's just an illusion. It's just life is like that. It's either a mystery or a dream, and sometimes a bad dream and occasionally a good dream. Even the good things come like that. Of course, when the good things come, we immediately like to think of how we deserved it. Yes, yes, I had a good thought just now, so the good thing has come. Yes, yes, yesterday or the day before, maybe last year I did something good. That's why that's coming. But when the bad things come, we tend to be like Mrs. Bennett. Why did all those people make mistakes and cause problems for me? Why am I surrounded by fools and people who do the wrong thing? And some areas we feel we're in charge. Some areas we feel that we have to follow the rules. It's not just the rules of society. It's not just the rules of our employer. We have rules even at the center here. When you can come, when you can go, what you can do, when we can speak, where we can sit, who gets the flowers. Everything has a rule. But rules are there for our body. Rules are there for the world around us. And they seem to be things that can't be violated. Science studies the rules of nature, the laws of nature. So we have to be able to explain these three phenomena that are very real to us, even if it's very confusing. And that is explained by these three powers of the three aspects, Maya, Prakriti, Shakti. Maya is the power of the Brahman or the Atman to conceive anything and to make it real. Like Jane Austen can write any kind of story she wants, and she can make anything happen in the story that she wants to have happen. And Prakriti is what we see as law, rule. We call it nature. Yes, yes, nature is like that. It's the monsoon season. It will be raining like this, and now the termites are coming out, and the flying white ants are there. It happens every year. And you can't plant crops in the wrong season because they'll get either starved or flooded with water. You have to follow the laws of nature. And we also know that we have nature. We call it human nature. Yes, yes, like Mrs. Bennett's nerves. We all have a nature. Yes, yes, I'm very impatient. Sometimes I'm short-tempered. Darcy says he's resentful. Once he gets angry at a person, he doesn't forgive them. We say Lizzie is cheerful. That's her nature. There are laws for us also. We use that to explain and make excuses for ourselves. You know my nature is like that. Don't bother me. I can't help it. It's my nature. If we say, I can't help it. That's my nature. What can I do? So even for us, Prakriti acts. Even Prakriti is determining us. And there are certain areas where we feel in charge, where we are, I'm the boss, here, do what I say. This is the Shakti. And there are certain areas where we feel Mother determines everything. And if you're devoted to Mother, if you have faith in Mother, if you follow her laws or rules, she will take care of you. She will protect you. She will give you prosperity. She will give you health. She will give you joy. She will give you accomplishment. She will give you spiritual blessings. In those areas, we're conscious of her. So how do we put this all together? Three aspects, a transcendent aspect, the witness aspect, the creator, three powers of that aspect. One that seems to do anything she wants, that's Maya. One who follows rigid laws, that's Prakriti. And one that responds to us, to our prayers, and has the infinite power to make anything happen now. Who's in charge? Is Maya in charge? Is Prakriti in charge? Is Shakti in charge? Are they up there fighting with one another all the time? How does it work? The divine seems to have created a very complicated universe. Who's really governing this? That's what he tells us in this chapter. And the short answer is, Atman, Purusha, and Ishvara are not three different gods, not three different beings. They're three different expressions of one. Maya, Prakriti, Shakti are not three different divine mothers, not three different creative powers. They're three different aspects or personalities, sides of the same power. We see one or the other. And the more and closer we see, we will see behind Prakriti, we will discover the Shakti is there. We will discover they are all really one who shows themselves in different sides. Just like you know, each of us knows, we are a father or a mother, a son or a daughter, a husband or a wife, a friend, a neighbor, an employer or an employee, a boss or a subordinate, and even as bosses we have subordinates, and even as subordinates we have somebody we boss. We are not one or the other of these things. We are all of these things, all of them together. It sounds very confusing when we try to read about it, but we don't have that confusion in our own lives. We know exactly who we are when we talk to our wife or our husband. We know what role we're in when we talk to our child or our neighbor or our parent or our boss or our employee. We are able to be all of these things at once. But if you try to describe this to somebody and write a chapter on it, they would wonder who's in charge and how do you know which is there at which point. That's the problem here. When it comes down to the fundamentals, when we get to the real essence of this, we can discover who's in charge and how everything's governed in the universe. But the knowledge we want is not just a theoretical knowledge. We want a practical knowledge. When I go out and the car won't stop, or there's no power, I want to know how to make the car stop. How to make the power. If I'm not getting the promotion or my child's not getting the grade, the marks in school, I want to know what can I do about it. If I'm not getting enough money to buy that flat or to move to a new house, I want to know how to do it. I want to know how to, it's not enough to have a theoretical knowledge. I want to know the power. How to become the Ishvara in my own life. So for that, we need to take the theoretical knowledge and see how we're really looking at our lives and how we understand it. And that's the, I kind of think of these three like, maybe if you look at the story, Mr. Bennett. Sometimes Mr. Bennett likes to be in the library left to himself. He just doesn't pay any attention to the rest of the family at all. He cuts himself off, aloof. He's like the silent, immobile self. The family goes on by itself and we say, Mrs. Bennett is running the family. That's Maya doing everything. Atman is not minding his own business, enjoying himself, contemplating whatever he does. Maya is in charge of everything. There are other times Mr. Bennett comes out of the library and he looks around and sees the silly girls and the mother talking with each other, laughing, giggling, talking about lace and getting husbands and all. And he's amused by the whole thing. He watches the whole thing. And as long as it doesn't get out of hand, he just allows it to go on. If they get too excited or too angry, or if Mrs. Bennett has a crazy idea like making Lizzie marry Collins, he puts an end to it. He says, stop, enough. And when Mrs. Bennett wants to tell him about the lace on the gowns of all the ladies, he said, not the lace, not the lace. stop. I withdraw my sanction. No more. He's the Purusha. He has the sanction. And occasionally, when things get desperate, he puts his foot down and says, I'm the man of the household. I'm in charge. No more officers, kitty. You're going to, no more balls. Nothing. You're going to be at home. I'm not going to Mr. Bingley again. I called on him once. He didn't marry my daughters, as you promised. I'm not calling on him again. He puts his foot down. He becomes the Ishwara. So we can understand this that way. There are three types of husbands, or rather husbands who can act in three different ways. There are three types of wives, or rather wives who can act in all of these ways as well. Because this is natural to existence. They're not three husbands or three wives. They're three aspects of the same, and sometimes we don't know which one we're going to entertain. Sometimes the husband thinks he's the boss and he's going to put his foot down, and the wife asserts and says, not yet. In this area, you go back to the library. I'm in, when it comes to the kitchen and what we're cooking, I'm in charge. Sometimes it's the opposite. So let's look at these three a little more to understand what they are and why they are the way they are. It's really quite simple when you get the concept. It's quite confusing when we read it all in the book, in spite of all his efforts to make it clear. So Brahman, we know, is Satchidananda. Brahman rather manifests to us as Satchidananda. We can't say Brahman is Satchidananda, but we know Satchidananda is Brahman. It's the way we can know Brahman. It's a pure infinite existence, an infinite consciousness, and an infinite force. And it's this Satchidananda that becomes three aspects and their powers. Everything comes from this transcendent Satchidananda, which is the origin of all, and it's really Satchidananda that becomes the universe, Satchidananda that becomes the Atman, the Purusha, the Ishwara, Satchidananda that becomes Maya, Prakriti, Shakti. How does it happen? This Satchidananda we know, existence, consciousness, bliss, consciousness, force, bliss, I'm leaving bliss out for now because it's everywhere, is one reality. But it has the capacity to separate itself so that it looks to us as more than one reality. And when Satchidananda separates itself so that existence is on one side and conscious force is on the other, we have the formula of Atman and Maya. They're all one, but they can differentiate themselves. So one of the ways they differentiate themselves is existence on one side. That's the Atman, the pure existent, the pure reality. But it doesn't seem to be aware of anything, and it doesn't seem to be doing anything. And on the other side, you have Maya, who's the consciousness force of that existence. So it separates this way, and we get the idea that the divine doesn't care about us. He's like Mr. Bennett hiding in the library, and Mrs. Bennett's in charge. That's what it looks like to us. But it's only one aspect of the truth. Because the divine can do it otherwise also. It can separate the existence and the consciousness on one side and the force on the other. So the existence and the consciousness are together. That's the conscious being. That's Purusha. The conscious being is there watching everything, but doesn't seem to be acting, doesn't seem to have the force. All the force is there with Prakriti. But Prakriti seems to be mechanical, seems to be inanimate, seems to just be happening according to some rules or laws, not by some decision. We don't say that Prakriti decided to do this. We said this is the laws of nature that are like that. It's the same reality, but it has a way where it can combine differently. So when the existence and the consciousness go together, we have a conscious being. And what's left is the force, which seems to be not conscious. Prakriti is what the scientist studies. Nature, we don't say that nature created all of these things intentionally. We don't know how it created it or why it created it. It just functions without thought. It's one way of seeing the reality. And we can divide it another way, or rather, we can see that they're all one. The existence, the consciousness, and the power are really one reality, inseparable. And this is Ishvara Shakti. Because when you know the Ishvara, you really know the Lord. The Ishvara, the Shakti, is when you know the Shakti, you really know the Lord. When you know Mother, you really are knowing the truth of existence, the divine. Because, whereas when Mr. Bennett's in the library and Mrs. Bennett's outside, they look like they're two independent things. When Mr. Bennett comes out to watch what's going on, at least you know it's a family, they're related to one another, and she only gets away with it because he permits it. But when Mr. Bennett is, when she's acting according to the will of Mr. Bennett, they're inseparable from one another. They're a real family. They're a team. They're mother and wife. They're husband and wife as one, acting as one, thinking as one. This is Ishvara Shakti. They're not three different realities or six different realities, but they can work in different ways. And in the cosmos, they can work in different ways at the same time. The Brahman can be acting and looking in some ways as if it's Purusha Prakriti, in some ways as Atman Maya, in other ways as Ishvara Shakti. But he tells us in this chapter that the ultimate truth is, whatever the appearance, however we experience it, really the divine is the Lord of everything. And everything that happens, happens with the sanction of the Lord. Everything that happens is the action of the Divine Mother in the universe. There is nothing that can happen. There is nothing that does happen. There's no ignorance that can exist. There's nothing that can exist without its sanction, without its determination. So this six is there to help explain the way we experience things. But the ultimate reality is Mother, the Divine Mother, is governing everything because she's expressing the will of the Ishvara, the will of the Lord, of the creator of existence in everything. So three different ways of seeing. But he wants us to understand all three. It's not enough we summarize, well, Mother's in charge of everything and everything happens according to her will, because no matter how much our faith is, tomorrow morning when things go wrong, we're going to be really confused, and how does Mother do things like this, and why is it all happening this way? So we really need to understand all these aspects and why the divine appears as all these aspects. And that's what he's telling us in this chapter. So first, the self, or Atman. The self is that experience of the divine reality that's silent, uninvolved, static. It's universal. It's not something you can pin down to a place or an individual. It's impersonal. It's the impersonal aspect. We don't think of the self as a being or a person. The self is not up there thinking things or doing things or willing things. It's an impersonal existence, spiritual existence. And this is one truth of the divine, which we have to understand, because the whole world does not experience, we don't experience the whole world as a being or as something that a person is doing. Many things seem to be impersonal to us, like the law. It may be people that make the law, but the law is impersonal. That's the rule. The center closes at this time and opens at that. It's the rule. The rule is impersonal. The law is impersonal. The weather seems to us to be impersonal. Gravitation is impersonal. It doesn't make distinctions between us. If we fall, we all fall. We don't, some of us go up. So this impersonal aspect comes from the self. This self is transcendent of the universe. It's cosmic. It's also individual. But when we experience the self, we really mostly experience it as the transcendent. When you experience the self, you really discover the real reality of my being is not here, not even there. It's beyond everything. It's immortal and eternal. And that's why he says, to experience the self is to experience the eternal freedom of the spirit, the eternal freedom of your spirit. That's freedom from your body, freedom from your vital, freedom from your mind, freedom from your evolution, freedom from everything. It means you're free from hunger and sleep and anger and jealousy and competition and ambitions and aspirations and everything. You're free from everything there. There's nothing you can ask for, nothing you can need, because it's an eternal, infinite freedom. That's the truth of your being. That's the truth of everyone's being. That's the truth of the universe and beyond the universe. So if we really want to be free, the experience of the self is essential. And that self, that freedom, has a power to create anything it wants. And that power is Maya. So when we reach the freedom of the self, we know that everything that's being done is being done by Maya. Maya is our aspect. We're free. We don't have to think of anything. Maya does everything. But really, it's our own power, because Maya and Atman are not separate from one another. They just appear that way. And the second aspect of the reality, the conscious being, what we call spirit, Purusha, is the witness. Everything that happens in nature happens with the sanction of the Purusha. It's the Purusha that's enjoying. The Purusha is also individual in us. It's also transcendent. But when you realize the Purusha, you most of all become conscious of the fact that behind the cosmos, behind the world, the universe, there's a being. The world is not just an impersonal place. There's really, the world is a being. It is a person. There's a power behind there, a real being in charge of everything. That's the experience of the Purusha. And when we realize that Purusha, we see the rest of everything that's happening as if it's the work of Prakriti. It's happening by itself according to mechanical laws. And then the third, the Ishwara. We discover that the reality is really the Lord of everything, the controller and creator of the universe, omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent, not only conscious of everything, but conscious in everything, inhabiting everything, in each of us. And this is the aspect of the reality that's closest to us, because it's individual. It's individual in each of us. The divine, the individual divine exists in each of us, or to put it more correctly, each of us is the individual divine. And that individual divine is one with the cosmic divine and the transcendent divine. But it's a being, and it's capable of individuality. And if it wasn't for this aspect of the Ishvara, none of us could exist, or at least none of us could ever hope to be divine or have a divine life. The reason we can hope to have a divine life is because we are divine in our inmost being. We're not only created by the divine, because I suppose the divine can create puppets or create something else. We are created of the divine. We are the divine. We are the creator. And the reason we can acquire mastery in life, the reason we can make a progress, the reason we say if you have a problem, you can solve that problem. Or rather, if you consecrate it to Mother, Mother can solve that problem, which still means you must do something. You must at least have faith. Be sincere. Be true to Mother. Somewhere we come into the picture. The reason we come into the picture, we're not helpless in this whole scheme of things, is because the divine is in each of us. The source of our power is because we are the divine. It's not like the divine is up there making all the decisions. The divine is inside us and inside everyone and inside everything making the decisions. So we say, well, if Mother's acting or if everything's determined by the divine, I'm helpless. There's nothing I can do about it. It's a hopeless case, as Mr. Bennett says. But no. There, we have the capacity to express the divine will in us. It's the divine will in us which is our aspiration. It's the divine will in us which is our faith. So when we decide I'm going to be sincere to Mother, what we really mean is I'm going to be sincere to the truth of myself. When I'm going to have faith, what we really mean is I'm going to have faith in the truth of my being, which is divine. I'm going to be sincere to that. I'm going to have faith in it. I'm going to consecrate to it. It means I'm not going to do what the ego wants. I'm not going to do what my vital wants. I'm going to do what my soul wants, and my soul wants what the divine wants. I'm going to do the divine will is really the will of my inmost being. The aspiration of my psychic is to express the divine in my life. So when Appa writes and says, you can become anything you want to become, you can do anything you want to do, you can solve any problem you want to do, or if he writes and says, Mother can remove all problems, 3-day prayer can wipe out any difficulty, it means when we go to the truth of our being and relate to the truth of the Divine Mother from that point, she acts through us, she acts through the life around us, she acts infinitely because we allow her to act, because we don't insist on our privilege of being ignorant. We don't insist on our privilege of being absorbed in suffering and in love with the taste of ignorance. So the truth of our own power, this chapter is not about the power of the divine, the transcendent alone. This chapter is about the power of each of us. The whole book, Life Divine, is not about the great power of the divinity that's going to save us all. The great truth of this book is about the great power of each of us to discover the truth of our being and to become that. Well, it's not one or the other, because Mother is our being. Mother is there working all the time to help awaken that being in us. It's our aspiration. You know, he says in the book, The Mother, there are two powers alone that can affect the progress and the transformation. There must be the call from below, the aspiration. Why must there be the aspiration? Because we're divine. We have to decide we want to come out of the ignorance. If we're enjoying the ignorance, we can stay here as long as we want. Nobody's going to compel us to come out. We have to want to come out because we are divine. The divine is not going to tell us what to do because it's us. That means something in it is enjoying the ignorance, enjoying the confusion, enjoying the competition and the jealousy and everything, and wants the experience, okay? Enjoy it as long as we want. But when we want to come out of it, it's not left only to us. The divine is there. Mother's there all around us. Mother's there wanting to awaken. Enough of this ignorance. There's more to better. The end of the story is better than the beginning. Enough of the quarrels. We'll like the end. Let's go further. There's plenty more. The story doesn't end with marriage. It doesn't end with Pemberley. It goes on and on. Let's try something new instead of, why do you want to play the whole thing over and over and over again? Enough of this mistakes and everything. For that, the call of the grace is there. It's not, we say we call and Mother answers. It's true. It's also true. Mother in us calls and Mother answers. The divine in us calls and the divine answers because they're not different. You call and Appa answers. It's not different. You call and your spouse responds as a miracle because the truth is there in all of us. The truth is there in all of life. You wonder when you pray to Mother, how come sometimes I don't know what to do in this situation? It's desperate. Your neighbor comes and offers a solution. So I have to go out, but my children are there. There's nobody. And your neighbor comes. Anything I can do for you? Because the truth is there in the neighbor. The truth is there in the child, in the spouse. The question is, are we going to relate to the ignorance in everyone around us and the ignorance in the world around us and the ignorance of the laws around us? Or are we going to relate to the truth that's there in everything? Behind Prakriti, behind Maya, behind every individual, there is that truth. And if Darcy sincerely prays, I want to become a good man, the divine responds through Wickham and comes and tells outrageous stories and lies about him and scandals about him and sends Lizzie to abuse him and help him come out of the ignorance. And when Lizzie is there lost in the ignorance of Wickham, she sends Charlotte to say, Lizzie, don't be concerned about Wickham. This Darcy's worth much more valuable. He's a better man. And Mrs. Gardner says, forget Wickham. You can't marry him. And Jane comes and says, I've heard bad things about Wickham. And Carolyn comes and says, oh no, Wickham's not what you think he is. And Darcy writes a letter and tells the whole thing to her. When she has the sincerity of wanting to wake up out of the ignorance, the truth comes from all around her in different forms to help her do that, because not only Mother up there, but the whole world is the Shakti acting. What we call life and life response is the response of the divine in life to us, to what we are, to help awaken us. So the secret formula is there is a divine up there, transcendent. There is a divine in everything cosmic. There is the divine in us. And the whole evolution is that these three should become one. How do they become one? Yes. Good. Very interesting. But of course, I think many of you can answer that question. But there's a very interesting thing about the Lady Catherine coming to Lizzie. I have wondered about it for a long time. Recently, it occurred to me. If you see the way Mrs. Bennett abused Darcy, when she comes to Longbourn, she abuses, when she comes to Netherfield to visit Jane when she's sick, she abuses Darcy for expressing surprise that Bingley would like to remain in the country. She says, no, we dine with 420 people. This is a very cultured place. You don't know. You don't know how wonderful this place is. She's very rude to him. She's very rude at the Netherfield ball. to him. She right across the table. She's speaking loudly about his offensive behavior. Lizzie's so embarrassed by her mother's behavior. Even after he's done everything, after he has saved the family, saved Lydia, got them married, sent Bingley with permission to marry Jane, when he calls at the house, she says, "You are also welcome, sir." Very rude. That rudeness to him, unjustified rudeness to him from the mother, comes back as unjustified rudeness from Lady Catherine to the daughter. Because all the rudeness that that Mrs. Bennet expressed is part of Lizzie's character. She's been angry at Darcy for months. She was accusing Darcy for months. She was feeling all the things her mother said, but she wouldn't express them. So she's the sanction for her mother's rudeness. That has to be wiped out. You can also say in the same way that Darcy believed all the things that Lady Catherine told Lizzie. Darcy has stopped thinking them, stopped expressing them, but at a deeper level of his being, there are still those inherited attitudes. Yes, we to be polluted by marrying and bringing Lydia into the family and Wickham into the family. Something in him will also feel that. So it comes to the surface as what Lizzie was capable of is expressed through the mother. The leftover reservations of Darcy are expressed from a distance. He doesn't express it anymore. He's pushing it out of his mind. He's pushing it out of his feelings. But it's not fully gone yet. It's so true that when Lizzie hears it, she says this is exactly what Darcy's thinking. She doesn't accuse him. But when Lady Catherine says, "Okay, if you won't listen to me, I will go to London and tell Darcy," she believes Darcy will agree with the aunt. Because it's true, at one level, those are Darcy's attitudes. But all that second, that's the way that explains how the divine is working in life and expressing the truth of things. But the real answer to your point is, what's the consequence of Lady Catherine coming and abusing Lizzie? The consequence is, Darcy says, only when my aunt came and told me that you refused to renounce a possible engagement, only then I had hope. It gave me courage to come back. It may be difficult for us to understand how hesitant Darcy was to go and propose a second time. For us, it's a story. For a man in his pride and prestige and his position in life to be abused the way he's been abused by her, to be said, "You're not a gentleman," to be said, "It was not even a month from the time I met you that I decided you're the last man on earth." He knows how opinionated Lizzie is. He knows how strong and courageous she is. How can he imagine that she's going to reverse? He's unable to imagine that she would reverse. Especially, she doesn't know what he did. As far as he's concerned, she doesn't know that he saved the family. Even if he saved the family, she can be grateful. But British girls are not in the habit of marrying a man just out of gratitude. They want to marry a man they love. And she has frankly told him, "You're the last man on the world I could love." So Lady Catherine did a great service. It's the same thing for Lizzie. Did you ever wonder? So Lady Catherine comes to Longbourn and abuses Lizzie, accuses her, and says, "I heard you're getting engaged." It's not real to her. It never occurs to her that Darcy's really planning to come and propose to her. She would like it to happen very much, but nothing in her believes it. Not only her. So Mr. Bennet said, why did Lady Catherine come? The rest of the family, everybody knows Lady Catherine has come to Longbourn. It's an extraordinary thing. In a million years, Lady Catherine won't come to Longbourn. Yet when Lady Catherine comes, Mr. Bennet says, why did Lady Catherine come? Did she come to talk about her engagement? He's joking. He never even asked, what did Lady Catherine say? Why did Lady Catherine come? Mrs. Bennet never asks. Nobody in the family asks her, Lizzie, what did she say to you? What made her come here? What is this extraordinary behavior? Why? Because to all of them, the idea that Darcy's going to marry Lizzie is inconceivable. Absolutely inconceivable. How did Lady Catherine know about the possible engagement? Darcy's not told anybody. Bingley doesn't know about it. Lizzie doesn't know about it. Nobody knows about it. But how does Lady Catherine know about it? Because there are two people in the world who know that this engagement is very likely. One is Charlotte. Because from the beginning, Charlotte has understood this man's in love with her. He's looking at you that way. Yeah, why is he staring at me? Because he's in love with you. He comes to dance with you. It's a great honor. Why does he do that? He came to Hunsford. She said, Darcy certainly didn't come to Hunsford on the first day of his arrival to see Collins and myself. He must have only come for you. That man's in love with you. Nobody else knew it. Nobody else could see it, though it was right in front of them. The only other person who could conceive of it was Mrs. Gardiner. When Mrs. Gardiner saw his behavior at Pemberley, saw the way he's looking, saw the way he's behaving, especially considering her relatives from Cheapside, she's heard all of that. This is a man, he's behaving like a lover, not like a host. That's why Mrs. Gardiner was shocked when Lizzie wrote asking for an explanation, what was Darcy doing at Lydia's wedding? Mrs. Gardiner is bewildered. She said, if you refuse to understand, if you pretend that you don't understand what happened, she's not able to believe because she assumed all along that Darcy and Lizzie are in communication with each other and that she knows Darcy's doing it for her. But Lizzie, even after she knew, even after she saw the behavior at Pemberley, even after Darcy danced with her, even after he proposed at Hunsford, even after he was so gracious to her uncle and aunt at Pemberley, even after she found out from from Mrs. Gardiner that he has saved the family, she couldn't bring herself to imagine that he's really going to come back and propose. After all of that, when Lady Catherine came and said, I go to London and talk to my nephew, she was sure she'll never see him again. Why? It's a very interesting point. For both of them, why? Because they were unable to conceive of what they could achieve. The achievement was sanctioned. The limitation was in their conception. And that's the problem for all of us. When Appa says 100 crores, where's the question? The mind stops. The heart stops. Or we just look there blank and dumb like Lizzie did when Lady Catherine came, and why did she come here and why is she saying all of these things? We mistake our incapacity to conceive for an incapacity to achieve. Whereas the limit is really in our conception, or if you wish, in our faith. It's already sanctioned. Appa sees the 100 crores is sanctioned the same way he saw the cars and houses were sanctioned for everybody 10, 12 years ago. He sees it's a reality. But if Darcy's afraid to go back and propose, how will he know? How will he find out? In his case, he doesn't even ask. He simply has the courage to go there. He shows up for a third time. Twice he came with Bingley, then he comes back a third time after Bingley's engaged. He doesn't propose to her. He goes walking with her. He's still very shy. He wants to propose, but when he's in front of her, he's speechless. It's she who says, "You must permit me to express my gratitude." Only then he has the courage to come up and say, "I just want you to know my feelings haven't changed. If your feelings are still the same, I'll never open it again. You don't need to shout at me or abuse me anymore." Because he couldn't conceive. That's our difficulty. When we can't conceive, we need a Lady Catherine to come and do our work for us. We need somebody to come and abuse us and say, "You idiot, you're missing the whole reality, all the opportunity, all that Appa has told you about, all that Mother's prepared for you. You're blind, foolish, you're lost in ignorance." We need a role of Mr. Wickham and Lady Catherine in our life to help us come out of the ignorance when we can't come ourselves. Then that's grace. That shows how great is the grace surrounding us in our lives. Become more conscious and we won't need more. They'll start talking in the opposite way. So, let's go back to the divine governance of the universe. He says, the mistake we make in trying to understand the way the world works is, either we think of it as if God is simply sitting up there pulling the strings and doing everything. He calls it an anthropomorphic view. Anthropomorphic means we think of God as like he's a man. A human being. We think there's a human God up there who would do things the way we were doing it if we were in charge. If we were in charge, we would be up there saying, "This is wrong, this is right, this is good, this is bad. I'd give you a candy, I'd give you a job, I'd give you something. No, you're doing things wrong, I will give you trouble." That's the human conception of a divine. The other mistake we make is the scientist mistake. We think that the governance of the universe is all by laws and rules and mechanisms and karma or fate or destiny, and it's got nothing to do with us. Either we want to be good so we win approval, or we feel we're helpless because everything's governed impersonally and we don't have any impact on it. He says, both these views have a truth in them, a truth at least in appearance. Because there are times if we pray to God, pray to Mother, she immediately answers. And there are times where we seem to get caught in the mechanisms of things, like a snowball rolling down the hill and can't turn it around. We make a mistake, and when we see it repeating over and over and over and over and over again, and we don't know how to get out of it, until again we pray that, "Mother, please dissolve my karma, enough, enough of this foolishness." So these are the way life appears to us. But the truth is neither the anthropomorphic God who's giving out sweets and punishments or the mechanical law. The truth is, behind everything is the will of the Supreme. Behind everything is the Ishwara. Behind Wickham's lies, behind Lady Catherine's abuse, behind Mrs. Collins' proposal. It's very interesting about Collins. I missed it for 10 years. The whole story starts with Collins. Because 1 month before the Netherfield ball, he wrote a letter to Mr. Bennett saying, I want to come here and an offer of goodwill to overcome the old quarrels between my father and you. I want to come and marry one of your girls. The letter, we hear about the letter only one third of the way through the book, but the letter was written a month earlier. Mr. Bennett says it was very urgent, so I replied within 15 days. That's his idea of urgency. And 15 days after that, Collins comes and visits. So before Bingley has come to Meryton, before Darcy's come to Meryton, before Wickham has come to Meryton, Collins has written. Why has he written? Very interesting, coming to Lady Catherine. Because she said, Mr. Collins, get married. So the original inspiration of goodwill for the whole story starts with Lady Catherine. Expresses through Collins. Expresses through the goodwill of Charlotte, who miraculously, where do you find somebody like Charlotte, who in spite of the fact she's 27, plain, no dowry, and sure she'll be an old maid, is worried about Jane and Lizzie getting married. The goodwill comes through them, so naturally they're the first ones married. Naturally. So we miss the significance of everything. Behind Lady Catherine telling Collins, go get married, is Tadastu, is the divine sanction. Behind Collins coming and proposing, supposing he's proposed to marry, she would have accepted and tried to reform him and improve him. She proposed to the one girl in the family, which absolutely impossible. Even Jane, even if she doesn't love him, she would have found it very difficult to say no to Mrs. Bennett. But Lizzie won't fool around with anybody. No is no is no. I cannot marry that man. It's impossible. So what a grace that he comes and proposes to Lizzie. And how just it is that Mrs. Bennett acts in such an outrageous manner that he wants to run away from the Bennets and not marry any of the girls. Because the one who really deserves it is Charlotte. Because goodwill is rewarded. Because goodwill is the awakening of the divine in Charlotte. Goodwill is her psychic coming out. So there's a truth in Lady Catherine, apart from all her offensiveness. There's a truth in Mrs. Bennett in her inspiration to force Lizzie and drive it away. There's a truth even in Wickham's abuses, because there's a sanction behind everything. So if you're lucky enough to have lots of Lady Catherines around you, then you should know that Tadastu is everywhere. Helping us to awaken. This is the central message. The three statuses and the three powers are not three separate statuses and three separate powers. They're three appearances of the same. To put it in terms of our story, whether Collins is proposing or Wickham is telling lies or Lizzie is abusing, or Mrs. Bennett is acting in such an outrageous manner, or Mr. Bennett is being lazy and irresponsible. What's behind all of it? Or Lizzie is eloping. What's behind all of it? Behind all of it is Jane Austen. Behind every character in the story and every event in the story is Jane Austen. There's nothing that happens in the story that can happen without her will. And if it wasn't for her action at all these points, it's Jane Austen who cancels the trip to the Lake Country and makes them come to Derbyshire. It's Jane Austen who determined that Mrs. Gardiner grew up in Derbyshire. It's Jane Austen who makes Darcy come a day early and meet Lizzie at Pemberley. It's Jane Austen who makes Collins a fool. And Mrs. Bennett had weak nerves, and Kitty coughed, and every other thing in the story. But without that genius of Jane Austen behind everything, behind the abuses and scandals and elopements, as well as behind all of the things we call positive, the story would never reach its... Darcy wouldn't have been transformed. Lizzie would not have risen from the vital to the mind. Mr. Bennett would not have become the real gentleman of honor and raised the whole family. So Tadastu is there. The divine is there behind everything. The things we think are good, the things that are bad, the things we think are pleasant or unpleasant. Not that the divine is sanctioning our punishments or our sufferings. What comes to us are the necessary conditions for us to awaken to the divinity in us. Just as surely as what comes to Darcy as Wickham's scandal or Lizzie's abuse are the necessary conditions for his awakening to the truth of his own being. This is the central message of this chapter. So, in summary, the three statuses are complementary to one another. As self, the divine supports, is the foundation for all existence, supports all existence, and informs all existence. The self is the gold that becomes everything, the substance of everything. As the Purusha, the divine is the conscious being that experiences everything. Not just experiences it up there, experiences it in us. There's the Purusha behind our mind, the Purusha behind the vital, the Purusha is the source of all consciousness, the Purusha behind the physical. All experience is there because the divine is experiencing in us, in others, in the world, and from beyond the world. And the divine is the Lord and Master that wills, governs, possesses, and determines all. And these are not three different divines. These are three different aspects of the divine. And he says, of them all, that which appears to be the closest to the ultimate truth is the divine as Ishvara Shakti. The divine has all these aspects. They're all real. But that which is closest to our really understanding the governance of the universe and our relationship to the divine is Ishvara Shakti. Because the self is transcendent, mostly impersonal. But the Ishvara is personal, sitting in our heart, is there in all of us, in each of us, in everything, determining everything. So the greatest truth and knowledge and power comes to us by relating to the Ishvara. And he says, our relationship to the Ishvara is through the Divine Mother, is through the Shakti. And that's the whole basis for his yoga. So he says, as we have reconciled infinite and finite status and action, form and formlessness, we must also reconcile the one and the many. We must understand that the one is not other than the many. It's the one that becomes the many and never ceases to be one. It's an indivisible one. It's not a one that's less than two. It's a one that includes all numbers. This is what he calls the mathematics or the logic of the infinite. So the one and the many are not other, not different from one another. In the normal view of things, the many are created by God the way a potter creates vessels, pots. But from the larger view, the one becomes the many, doesn't create anything. It becomes the many and continues to be the one. Even though we are the pots, we continue to be the potter. We are the one that is expressing a part of that infinite oneness through many different expressions of manifestation. All the characters in Pride and Prejudice are emanations of Jane Austen. They exist only by Jane Austen, in Jane Austen, are of Jane Austen. Each is an aspect of her creative imagination. None of them is separate. None of them is independent. None of us are independent from the one, which is the creator of all. We have the choice to pretend or to believe that we're totally independent, not just from God, but from everybody else. Or we have the choice to rediscover the fact that we are the one, and not just we, but everybody else is the one, like the disciple who complained to the guru that he was walking down the road and the elephant came and the elephant threw him out of the way, and he complained, I told last time, he said, what is it, you told me I'm Brahman, and the elephant goes and pushes me around, and he said, yes, you are Brahman, but so is the elephant, and the Ahurkanda elephant, and everything is Brahman. So if we don't choose to be ignorant, we can discover the oneness in ourselves and the oneness in everybody else. Our problem, or maybe it's our opportunity, is that we're not aware of our oneness. We're aware of the ego. We're aware of our separateness. We're aware of the fact that nobody's doing things the way they should be doing, meaning nobody's doing what I want them to be doing. Life is not cooperating and giving me everything I want. Everybody's not living for me. I feel helpless in this area, annoyed in this way, aggravated in that way. My poor nerves are burning like Mrs. Bennett. Because things are not right, because I'm living in the ignorance of the ego. So for us, the key is to get out of the ignorance of the ego is not our true self. The ego is not immortal. The ego is not eternal. The ego is not a true being at all. It's like looking at yourself in a distorted mirror and trying to preserve the image in the mirror. It's only a poor, very poor reflection or a very poor photograph of the real being. We must discover the real being that's reflected and not live in the illusion of the ego. So he tells us the formula. How do we do this? How do we get out of the ignorance of the ego? He tells us the formula is by the self-giving and surrender of the soul in nature to the Divine Mother. When we say we're going to surrender, how can I give up everything? Mother's got everything, I have nothing. The only thing we can give up is our poverty and our ignorance and our smallness and our narrowness and our selfishness. We can't give up anything because our true nature is infinite. We can't give up anything even if we tried because everything belongs to us. If you're in your great generosity, we give an offering at the center, or we are generous with our relatives or anything like that. The only thing we can give up is our smallness. The only problem we have is that we want to possess things, that we think we have to take care of ourselves. All we have to do is give up our ego, give up our selfishness, give up our self-centeredness, forget ourselves, to discover that we are infinite. Because that's hard to conceive of. We give to Mother. That's why Mother is there. Mother is there as our greater self, as the truth of our being, so that by devotion to Mother, sincerity to Mother, self-giving to Mother, we can be true to ourselves. We can give not to our petty ego and the preferences of our petty ego, but to the, we can give to our own truth of our own being. We surrender to the truth of our own being, which is the divine being, or which is the divine mother. Then he says, there's one more difficulty that we need to overcome if we want to know the true truth of things. Maybe it's not a difficulty that you and I are worrying about, but ultimately, if we want to know, there's one more opposition we have to overcome. And that is the opposition between the manifestation and the non-manifest. And that's particularly strong in the tradition, because the tradition says the goal is to get out of manifestation and go to the unmanifest. In fact, the tradition says the soul itself is only a temporary. The real destiny of the being is to go back to Satchitananda and dissolve the soul. But what he says is, like all the other oppositions, the truth is complementary. The unmanifest is not other than the manifestation. The manifestation is an expression of the what is not manifest. What is there in potential in the transcendent manifests in the universe. They are not opposite from one another. The eternal and the infinite unmanifest is the base, but everything here is a real expression of that base. Not only a real expression, but it means ultimately our soul, our being, our individuality is also eternal. Obviously, not the body is eternal, not the ego is eternal. Our soul is also eternal. Not eternal, separate from every other soul, except eternal as a unique expression of the oneness of which we were all a part. So, our destiny is to live and evolve until we can be fully conscious of the fact that we are divine, immortal, infinite beings, and to continue to live and evolve after that, expressing the infinite riches and mysteries and secrets of the infinity, which is our true self. So that this poses one final difficulty for us, and I think it's the most difficult passage in the whole book, and that is the concept of time. Because we have a clear sense that time is a thing that once it's gone forever. And until it happens, it hasn't happened. And it's almost impossible for the mind to conceive that time is an expression of something else, because we live in time and our mind is in time. But he tells us if we really want to understand the governance of the universe, we have to come out of the contradiction that we have between the idea of time and timelessness. We may not wake up with it every day, but you'll see we think of time always. The past is over. When Appa says it's not too late, you can reverse. It's over. What can I do? And when Appa says you can bring the future now, the future hasn't come yet. The future hasn't happened yet. The future hasn't been determined yet. How can you bring it now? How can Appa say the 100 crores is real? Because for us, it doesn't exist until it's in the now. And if you had the 100 crores and lost it, now it's gone. And it's gone. And there's nothing we can do about it, because we live in the movement of time. But he says, and when we think of timelessness, we think of it as a big emptiness. There's nothing there. There's no past, there's no present, there's no future. To be in timelessness is kind of just to be in a trance. Nothing happens. That's our conception of timelessness. He says, that's not what timelessness is. In timelessness, everything is there. The past is there, the present is there, the future is there. Everything exists in the timelessness. It's not an emptiness. It's an infinite fullness. The only thing is, it's not in movement. We can understand, take Pride and Prejudice. If you've never read the book, you start at the beginning, you go to the time when Bingley arrives, Darcy proposes, Bingley leaves, then they meet at Hunsford, then Darcy proposes, then they separate for 6 months, then they meet at Pemberley, and so forth, until the end. But we know now the whole story. The whole story is there in the book, from beginning to end. Somebody who hasn't read the book, for them, no, I'm just at the point when Darcy's going to propose to her, and I don't know what she's going to say. Oh, no. But we know what he's going to say. We know, we can see the beginning of the story. We can imagine the news of Bingley arriving at Meryton. We can imagine the proposal at Hunsford. We can imagine the surprise of their meeting at Pemberley. We can imagine the wedding at the end, all at the same time. We can see them all. If we were movie producers and we took the film and put the film up, but they have the old-fashioned light boards the way they used to do things before you could do it on the computer, you could see all the frames of the story from beginning to end and look at it at once. You can see the whole thing at once without movement. Nothing is moving. Everything is there simultaneously. But when we watch the movie, we watch it at a particular point. We watch the movie from this point to that point. Sometimes you turn on the movie in the middle. Oh, now he's going to propose to her. Then what happens? Then she's going to abuse him. Then he's going to go out and write the letter. Then she's going to read the letter. We follow it step by step. But once we've seen it, we can go back and think about what happened at the dance, what happened at Netherfield, what happened with Wickham. We can go back to the forward, we can jump to the future. Think of it this way. Supposing you're a yogi sitting on the side of a river, and you see a boat going down the river. You're sitting there, there's nothing, and then suddenly a boat comes into view, and the boat passes you, and then it goes around a corner, and it goes out of view. You see life passing in time, and you say, you know, something very interesting just happened. A boat went by. When did it happen? Just 2 minutes ago, a boat went by. But what would you be seeing if you were in the boat? If you were in the boat, you were upriver, and said, something very interesting happened. I just went by a yogi sitting by the bank of the river. For you, the boat didn't go by. The boat has been moving all along. But suddenly you see the yogi, and then he disappears. The yogi came into view, and then he disappears, because you have a different perspective. Now, what happens if you're on top of a mountain? If you're on top of the mountain, you see the boat start at this end, going down to this end, and then you see the yogi, and at one point the boat passes the yogi. You see the whole thing. You see the past and the present and the future for both of them from a different perspective. So what does it mean? It means our concept of past, present, and future depends on our position. Are you in the boat, or are you on the river, or on the mountain? In other words, our conception of past, present, and future depends on our consciousness. To the man sitting on the riverbank, the boat just came into view. It didn't exist until then. And when it goes, it's gone. But for the man in the boat, the yogi just suddenly appeared and then the yogi disappeared. He's gone. That's the past event. That's what happened an hour ago or yesterday. Yesterday's gone. We can't get it back, right? When we pass the yogi, we can't get him back. But yet, that's how we think about yesterday. Now it's over. And what's going to happen tomorrow, we can't imagine. It doesn't exist yet. But on top of the mountain, you already see where he's going to go next. Now he's passing the yogi. The next time he's going to go by a house, and then he's going to come to a waterfall, and you can see the whole thing. So our understanding of time depends on our consciousness. We are in a particular consciousness of time, which we call the time consciousness. We're at a particular point where we are living at one moment at a time. We can't see what happened in the past. It's already around the corner. We can't see what's coming in the future. It's around another corner for us. They don't exist. At least the past we can remember through our memory, though we can't call it back. It's one thing to say this is what happened yesterday. It's another thing to say what happened yesterday is still there. You just don't see it. No. It's over for us. And it's another thing to say that tomorrow hasn't happened yet, or where somebody says, it's happened already. It's there already, but you just haven't seen it yet. You haven't got there yet. Because we are at that moment. We live in the moment. The only thing that's really real to us is the moment. So we believe only one moment exists at a time. And we think the past moments have stopped existing and the future moments haven't existed yet, haven't been created yet, because we live in the time consciousness of the mind. It's an ignorance. It's a limitation. There is a timeless consciousness in which everything exists, but it doesn't exist in the time flow. It's like Pride and Prejudice book. If you take Pride and Prejudice book, the whole story is there. But that's different than reading the story. It's different than watching the movie. But it's all there. And in our mind, the whole story is there. So if I ask you, go to the Pemberley, go to the wedding, go to the first proposal, jump to the second proposal, go to the original meeting, go to another field ball, you can do it. It's all there in your mind. But that's different than watching the movie and tracing it step by step from beginning to end. So the timeless consciousness is everything exists, but not as a movement. It's there in potential, like the story in the book, or like the memory in your mind. And there's a third status of mind in which we can know the whole thing exists. Which we do. We know the whole story. You all know the story of Pride and Prejudice. It's all there in your mind. At the same time, you can sit and watch the movie or read the book or listen to the narrative or tell the story and experience it moment by moment by moment. You already know the whole story. You already have the whole thing, but still, we can live in the moment. What are you going to say next? What's it now? It's there. Even if you've watched the movie 10 times or 100 times, you can just live in the moment at the same time. How is it possible? Because our consciousness can take multiple statuses at the same time within our limits of the mind. Well, the divine can take all of these poses and does take them all simultaneously. And this is the supramental time consciousness. It can be simultaneously aware of the timeless state, that's the whole book. It can be aware of the whole movement from beginning to end, like the man on the mountain who sees the boat going from beginning. It can be sitting there on the river and watching the boat go by. It can be sitting in the boat and moving along with the boat simultaneously, because it's an infinite consciousness. So when we reach the supramental consciousness, our sense of time will be very different. But what he's trying, so it comes as There's a double status of time. The timeless eternity, he says, is the spirit looking at itself in essence. It's looking at itself in essence. It's immobile, but everything is there in potential in it. And there's the time eternity, the spirit looking at itself in movement. It's dynamic. It's manifesting itself in a sequence in time. For us, we can do that with the story. The whole story there, when I say Pride and Prejudice, the story of Darcy and Elizabeth, you know the whole thing. It's there. You don't have to spell it out. You don't have to go through all of the things. Or you can experience it in the time movement. So what he wants us to know is both of these are the same eternity. The timeless eternity and the eternity of time are both the same eternity. The story is the same story, whether it's there in the book held in one thing, or we experience it moment by moment from beginning to end. It's two ways of experiencing the same thing. There's only one eternity. When we say our soul is eternal, even when we are living, there's a part of us that's conscious of the fact that we're infinite and eternal, that we live forever. There's a part of us which knows the past and the future. It's not conscious for us. That's the supramental truth consciousness. We are lost in the ego where we thought, all that happened yesterday is lost. And all that's going to come in future doesn't exist yet. But there is a point where nothing ever leaves and nothing ever has to come because it's already there. When Appa says the 100 crores is sanctioned, it's already there upriver. How quickly you're going to go down the river or whether you insist on waiting here and enjoying your place on the riverbank, that's the choice we make. How soon it can come depends on what we do, depends on our faith, depends on our consciousness. So there are three statuses of time. The timeless eternity, when we're conscious of that which is eternal and infinite, but there's no movement. That's there. That's us. We live in that, in the depths of our soul, because that's the nature, that's the foundation for our existence. There's the time movement. That's what we're in now. That's what we live in all the time when we're awake. Mother says when we go to sleep for at least a moment, we go back to Satchitananda. We go back to the timeless eternity, but we don't remember it. This is the thing where we're spending our time on the surface, in the time movement. We can achieve the simultaneous integrality of knowing the relationship between them, of knowing the relationship between the infinite eternal and the whole of the time movement and the moment. And we can be conscious of them all at once. And this is the supramental time vision. He has a chapter on it at the end of Synthesis. He says, this is the logic of the infinite. From our finite position, it sounds inconceivable, it sounds like a magic, it sounds illogical, because we're living in the logic of the mind that judges everything from the limitations of our own instrument. So, where are we in sum? We live in the ignorance. We experience the spirit as something other than ourselves, other than the world. It's otherworldly. It's unrelated to our lives. something, if we're going to get there, we're going to go from here to there. It's unconnected with us. We feel separate from each other, separate from the world around us, separate from God. Most of the time, or often, we feel helpless. We feel helpless because life is like that. Our friends and relatives are like that. Our spouse is like that. Our health is like that. The laws are like that. Our job is like that. The weather is like that. And so many other things are like that. Because we live in the ignorance. And though we often think our mission is to change our spouse or change our job or avoid the laws or escape from our health problems, our real challenge and the only problem and the only challenge we have is to escape from the ignorance. If we escape from that, we will find out there's nothing we need escape from. There's nothing we need acquire because everything comes to us of itself. The truth is, we are one with all souls, regardless of what Mrs. Bennett may think about Lady Lucas, or Lady Catherine may think of Lizzie. We're one with the whole universe and with the divine, because there's only one reality, and that reality is our reality. And when we discover the truth of ourselves, at the same time, we discover the truth of everybody else. And everything else, and everything that's beyond everything else. There's only one truth and one being to discover. We discover that the individual in us, not the ego, but the real true individual in us is eternal, immortal, and infinite. There's nothing to pray for. There's nothing to want. There's nothing to need. Because when you're infinite and immortal, you are everything. There's nothing to gain except the delight of expressing your individuality, your infinite individuality. The truth is, we are destined to become that. Sooner or later, we are destined to become that spiritual individual that is eternal and immortal, because that's what we are already. That's there. It's not something that has to happen. We only have to decide enough of this taste of ignorance. It's time for the taste of the truth and the adventure of truth. And we'll be there. The truth is that when we realize the truth of ourselves, we have the power over everything in our life. We become the Ishwara. In the measure we discover the truth of ourselves, we discover the truth or power over everything, meaning our life will be whatever we want it to be. As surely as Jane Austen can write the story with any ending she wants, we can write our life story with any beginning, ending, and middle as we want, and any adventure or joy as and delight as we want, because we are really the master. There. All of that is when we discover the truth. We are the creator. Like Jane Austen, we create our own story. We're creating our story right now. If this is the story we're in, it's the story we're choosing to be in. If we want to change the story, we can change it right now. If you don't want the Wickham to come and gossip, if you don't want Lady Catherine to come and abuse, if you don't want the elopement, you can change it right now. Even after it's happened, you can change it. If we want, we can come out of the ignorance at this moment and change the story from the next moment. Our thoughts, our attitudes, our consciousness manifest in the story we're living in. We can't change what's going on out there, even though we try, but we can change what's going on in here. And when we change our thoughts and our attitudes and our consciousness, everything out there changes automatically. That's what we call life response. We've all seen it. We've all seen it so many times, whether it comes by a change of attitude towards a person or by praying to Mother or by 3-day prayer or by consecration or by calling Mother, whatever it still is. What we're doing is not changing the world. We're changing our consciousness. And when we change our consciousness, the world automatically changes. Time is eternal. It's never too late to change or achieve. It's never too late because time is eternal and we are immortal. It's never too soon for anything to happen that you want to happen. No, I want it to happen, but I know it'll take a long time. It'll take a long time if you want it to take a long time. It'll take a long time if you believe it must take a long time. It's never too soon for anything to happen because it's already there. It's a question of which consciousness we're going to be in. Everything is simultaneously present at every moment. To change our consciousness means to surrender to Mother. To surrender to Mother means to surrender our ignorance and falsehood and inertia to the truth of our own being. Because Mother is the truth of our being. And Mother's infinite power is the truth and power of our own being. And Mother comes to us as another, as separate from us, not because she feels separate from us, because we feel separate from her. Mother has no illusion of the fact that we are separate from her. We are all part of her. We all live in her. We are all her consciousness. It's we who feel separate. It's we who feel, Mother, Mother, come to me, come to me, come to me. We call her. She's already there all around us all the time. We insist on thinking she's not there. Mother has deserted me because we're not thinking of her. We think the infinite has forgotten us. We have forgotten the infinite. The whole thing lies with our choice and our consciousness. Why has Mother forsaken me? Why is she doing this to me? Sometimes the devotees write to Appa and they say, why have you forgotten me? And I know several occasions where Appa has written back and said, who has forgotten who? We think the divine has forgotten us. When we have forgotten the divine, when we have forgotten the truth of our own being, why then is it so difficult to change? We've been having a very interesting discussion on this theme with Ashok for the last week. Why is it that we constantly repeat the same mistake over and over and over and over and over again? Why don't we learn the first time? Why don't we change? Because to change means to change our consciousness. Change doesn't happen without a change of consciousness. If we're really mental people, if we really live in our mind, it's enough we experience anything once and we learn from it. But very few people live in their mind at any time. Mind only needs one. You put your hand in the fire and it hurts and you put it out. Never put it in again. We learn. But that's not what we seem to do. We're constantly putting our hand and our foot in the fire. In one fire or another. Oh, this fire is like that fire. I thought it was different. Because we're not in a mental consciousness. If we're in the spiritual consciousness, we don't have to put our foot in the fire, our hand in the fire even once. Because we instinctively know fire is hot and it burns. But if we're in the physical consciousness, each time we put it in, the next minute we forget. And the next, what is this? Oh, it's hot. And each time, with great surprise, we're doing it again. And certainly, I'm sure if anybody writes the sequel to Pride and Prejudice, and if Mrs. Bennett has an opportunity to send Kitty to Brighton, she will. And if Kitty elopes, she'll think next time of sending Mary to Brighton. And she'll send her grandchildren to Brighton. Because she's in the physical consciousness, she never learns. She repeats over and over and over again, and at the end of it, what did she learn? She sits with Mrs. Phillips, and she says, you see, it was all their fault. She learns nothing. She never learns that the change of consciousness should be in her. Or we live, if we're not like that, in some things we're like that, in some things, most things, we live in the vital consciousness. For the vital consciousness, things are very simple. Whatever I like is good. Whatever I like is true. Whatever's pleasant is true. Whatever suits me is right. That's what Lizzie says. She's generous enough to express her vitality for us so we can live and laugh at it. She says, he's so handsome, he must be true. He's so nice to me, he must be good. Our definition of a good person is a person who's good to me. They may be a scoundrel with others, but as long as they're good to me, he's a good person. And when he turns and starts treating me the way he treated everybody, I don't know what happened to that man. I thought he was a good man. He's not a good man. Meaning, he's changed his behavior to us because the vital doesn't look at things as they are. We look at it simply in relation to how it serves us, how it suits our convenience. If it's convenient for me, it's right. If you want to give me something, that's in order. I must have done something to deserve it, otherwise you wouldn't give it to me. If you want me to give you something, that's not in order. I don't know why I should be giving something to you. I don't think anybody's done anything to deserve it. That's the way the vital thinks of things. Mr. Bennett lives in the vital when he sends Lydia to Brighton. He convinces himself that it's right. Say, I'll get no peace and quiet if she doesn't go to Brighton, as if his peace and quiet is the ultimate important thing in the world. Is his peace and quiet more important than the safety of the family, the safety of his daughter, the marriage of all of... He says, I get no... It's right. He convinces himself. He ignores Lizzie's warning. He ignored. How can anybody's father not know what Lydia is? You don't have to be a genius to know that Lydia is an irresponsible girl and she's capable of any impulsive act. But the vital is capable of that ignorance because it looks at things only from its own point of view. We change when we rise in consciousness. Normally, we rise in consciousness only when our experience is saturated at the present level. Meaning, enough is enough. I'm not going to repeat this again. It's very clearly brought out with Lizzie. First, Charlotte says, you better forget Wickham. There's Darcy. Mrs. Gardner comes and says, you can't marry Wickham. Forget it. Carolyn warns her about Wickham. Jane warns her about Wickham. Darcy writes the letter, which tells everything. But finally, she only gives up Wickham when? After the elopement. It's not enough that she learns from the letter of Darcy that this scoundrel tried to elope with Georgiana and almost ruined Georgiana's life and ruined Darcy's family. She believes it. It's not that she doesn't believe it, but it doesn't, that information in her mind doesn't saturate her experience until she feels what it's like to have Wickham elope with your sister and ruin your family. She doesn't learn because she's in the vital. That's not necessary for us. Everything we need to know, Mother has told us. Everything we need to know, Appa, is written in the books. Unless we insist on it, we can acquire that knowledge now and saturate that knowledge now by prayer, by reflecting on our own experience rather than insisting on repeating it over and over again. Another way to say that is, all the experience we need, we've already had. There's nothing more we need to experience in order to have all the knowledge. All we need to do is get the knowledge out of our experience. That's past consecration. If we simply now go back and learn all that we should learn from our lives up to this point, we will know everything we need to know for any achievement. I'm amazed that Appa, sometimes he'll mention that he was thinking about an event 50 years ago, and suddenly realizing its greater significance in his life and why something has happened later. You don't need to be out there getting the experience. We all have enough. But we haven't drawn the conscious knowledge from that experience. That's consecration of the past. If you have problems, go back and consecrate the whole problem from the beginning. All the knowledge you need, all the answer is already there. You don't need it from anything else. Make the progress that you should have already made from the abuse of the scandal of Wickham, or the abuse of Lady Catherine, or the abuse of Elizabeth, or whatever it is, or the elopement of Lizzie. Make all the progress you should have made from your past experiences. You'll have all the knowledge and power. You'll have everything you want now. Because it's all there. It's all sanctioned. If we don't learn, Mr. Bennett didn't need to take 25 years to learn that he shouldn't give Mrs. Bennett freedom to do anything she wants. He took 25 years. Finally, he put his foot down when the elopement came and said, no more officers. He could have learned it a long time earlier. We could also do it. We don't learn because we're enjoying our ignorance. We're enjoying our sense of superiority to others, or our pride, or our prejudice, or our anger, or our weak nerves, or our self-pity, or whatever it is, or all the things that other people enjoy. We enjoy the unconsciousness. We enjoy the experience of being unconscious. There are certain things I would rather not know about myself. When I think there are certain things I'd rather not know about myself, it means I prefer to stay where I am and not be better. I prefer to have all the problems I have now. The fastest way for me to make progress is to know everything about myself and not be that, then I change. We are where we are now because we have the self-righteousness of Lady Catherine, or the self-importance of Darcy, or the laziness of Mr. Bennett, or the insincerity of Mrs. Bennett. So it all comes down to one word: be sincere. Be willing to learn what life has already taught us or offered to teach us, what Mother and Appa are constantly offering to teach us, so that our consciousness can change and our world can change the next minute. Any questions? Questions from anybody? Anywhere? Yes. Is there a mic? I thought there was a mic. It's a very good question. It's a very, very good question. In a sense, we are trying to reconcile opposites all the time. Say, in the physical plane, we try to reconcile opposites by defeating the other person. In the story, Lydia takes Kitty's cap, and she wants her cap. She takes it away, they fight for it, and Kitty gets it. Reconciliation in the physical plane is by conflict. In the vital plane, we try to reconcile by competition. Mrs. Bennett is trying to steal a march over Lady Lucas by getting Jane married first. She gets disappointed because Charlotte marries first. There's no reconciliation in the physical consciousness or in the vital consciousness. Our idea of reconciliation in the mind is compromise. Okay, I'll give a little to you, you give a little to me. We'll compromise. We'll share it. I'll come halfway, you come halfway. There's no real reconciliation in the mind. So we've got conflict in the physical, competition in the vital, compromise in the mental. How does reconciliation really come about? Reconciliation is only possible when you're asking the opposite of what I'm saying. How can I reconcile with you? I want what I want. Only when I am willing to recognize there's a truth in what you're asking. When I compromise, it's not that I concede a truth in what you're asking. I see I don't have the power to get everything I want, so let me at least get as much as I can. I compromise with you. When I recognize there's a truth in what you're asking, and I'm eager to grant that truth, you will recognize the truth in what I'm asking, and we'll find the reconciliation so that the truth of each of us can be realized. Because falsehood can never be fully realized, can never be fully satisfied. If I make an outrageous false demand on you, even if you agree to it, I'll end up losing that thing. Somebody else will take it away from me. Because falsehood can never be. Falsehood is illusion. But if there's a truth in your position and a truth in my position, no matter how opposite they appear to be, there is a solution that will give you 100% your truth and me 100% my truth. That's the definition of truth. That can't be worked out in the physical, vital, or mental. That is the supramental consciousness. Because in the supramental consciousness, I know that what I want and what you want are the same. Rather, you are me. It's as important to me, it's as important for me for you to get what you want as for me to get what I want. Rather, I want for you what you want as much as you want it. I want for everybody what they want as much as I want it, as much as you want it or they want it. Because there is something that we can all have in infinite abundance. We can't all have infinite falsehood. We can't and expect to enjoy it. But we can all have infinite truth, and that infinite truth is infinitely great. So the real reconciliation comes when what we want is not what I prefer, not what's convenient for me, not what suits my laziness or my sense of self-importance or sense of self-injustice. When I want the truth, when I want what Mother wants, when instead of saying, Mother, please give me this, please give me that, I say, Mother, your will be done. Let thy will be done. Give me whatever you want. Let me be what you want me to be. Because when I am what you want me to be, I'll have everything. So the reconciliation is not in how we deal with the other person, but in our own consciousness. There is no reconciliation for the ego that feels separate from everybody else and wants to dominate over others or steal a march over them or negotiate and get a bigger share from them. That can only be a conflict, a compromise, or a competition. There is reconciliation when we want the truth, when we want to be Mother's child, when we want to be sincere. Very good question. Wonderful question. Ashok? Question?
Gary?
Yes.
In your speech, you talked about big fortune being actually real. and kind of waiting. Like you quoted Appa saying that the underpart, the undercross fortune is something real though not tangible to us.
Hmm.
In this connection, I would like to connect what happened in PNP. You see, Lizzie refuses the advantages of marrying Collins. The advantages seem to be really obvious, but something inside her does not agree with marrying Collins, so she rejects it outright. At the time she is rejecting Collins and his proposals, what is coming towards her, she has no idea. But it's because she rejected Collins, Darcy and Pemberley moved towards her. Though at the time of rejection, that was not real to her in her imagination or in her nerves. So like that, I see many devotees are tempted with what appears to be obvious immediate advantages. What you say is right, if they reject these obvious immediate advantages, though ethically they are not proper or though they are not in line with their values, do you mean to say if you reject what is the immediate obvious advantage which is not in line with mother's values, a much greater fortune will move towards the person?
Ashok, it's a wonderful question. I'm sorry that it didn't come out on the mic here because I would have liked everybody to hear the way you have phrased it so beautifully. I will try to first repeat what I've heard from you. I can't do it word for word. You've done it really beautifully. But I'll try to give the essence of it and then give you an answer. You commented on the fact that I said that everything exists simultaneously, including the future, including the 100 crores that Appa talks about. But our normal consciousness is we feel that if we give up an opportunity today or what we have today, we're losing. We may lose everything, what's coming or what's destined to come or what's there in potential is not real to us. And you quoted the story of where many devotees feel that Lizzie should have accepted or would have advised Lizzie to accept Collins' proposal because it's a very good proposal. At that time, she had no idea that what was being offered to her later. But of course, if she had accepted Collins' proposal, she would never have become Mistress of Pemberley. She would have missed all of that. So we are in the position, all of us, where we have something today and we have to make a decision without the knowledge of what's waiting for us down the river. Because we're not on the mountain and can see the treasure is there or Darcy standing just around the bend. And you said, today we compromise. We may compromise with what's right. We may compromise with what we believe. We may compromise in many ways because what's present physically is real to us. And we don't want to give up that reality for the sake of something that in our mind doesn't exist yet. So then you said, do you mean to say that if we refuse the compromise with today, that that other thing will come sooner, or it will come? That way Lizzie's story is beautiful, because it's self-evident in that case that Lizzie, out of her values as a human being, feels she's not judging Collins. She's simply saying, Collins is not meant for me. She says, honestly, I cannot make you happy and you cannot make me happy, which is true. And she certainly won't make Lady Catherine happy, but she may have sounded foolish to herself saying that, but that would have been very meaningful to Collins. And she said to Collins, you see, I'm sure I won't, Lady Catherine won't be happy with me. That would have convinced him, maybe. So many devotees feel that, and as Mrs. Bennett feels, what, you're giving up the entail, you're giving up security, you're giving up respectability, you're giving up something very real, for what? For some dream. But the truth for Lizzie is that if she has accepted Collins, it would be a total falsehood for her. It would be sacrificing her real aspirations as a human being. She wants love. She knows this is not a man she can love and respect. Even as a duty to her, him, she feels to marriage should be out of a respect and love for the other person. This is not a person I can love and respect. It's not fair to him for me to marry him just because it's property. It's not fair to myself to value myself only in terms of my property. I would rather miss the advantages of marrying than to take this for purely mercenary point of view, which is not fair to me and not fair to Collins. I would say she acts out of a deeper truth of her being, a truth of her being that Mrs. Bennett completely refuses to recognize. The truth of the matter for Mrs. Bennett is she wants the entail. Because if the entail goes, she doesn't know what she's going to do when Mr. Bennett dies. That's the thing for her. She's not even thinking of her daughter. She's not thinking, will my daughter be happy? She's not even thinking whether my daughter will get another proposal or can she get another proposal. She's thinking, this is what I want, and you must do what I want. From Mrs. Bennett's point of view, she's totally disqualified from getting what's waiting downstream. Because she's acting out of pure selfishness, pure ignorance, and pure falsehood. How can the best thing ever come to us when we insist on being selfish, ignorant, and false? The best that we can, how do we know that if we don't take this, we will get that? It's like saying, how do I know if I don't lie and steal and cheat to get what I can today, that something better will come from it? The moment my consciousness is no longer that of a liar or a cheat or a thief, automatically I will get something better. The reward is in the raising and changing the consciousness. We must know out of what, it's not a question, is this the best I'm going to get or is something better? How do I know what's around the corner? How do I know if the next offer will be better? The question is, out of what consciousness we act. If she has refused Collins out of a sense of arrogance, superiority, haughtiness, assertion, the next thing she got around the corner would have been worse, not better. She has been true. She tried to be polite. She wanted to avoid the whole thing. Her mother didn't allow her to avoid it. She tried to be very kind to Collins. He refused. He refused to believe her. She told him 3 times. Even then, she didn't abuse him. She simply walked out of the room in frustration. She was not unkind to him. She was helpless against him. Look at Collins. Collins didn't refuse her. But he finally accepted, instead of deciding to campaign more and more and more, he finally had the good sense to not insist on marrying a girl who didn't want to marry him. What happened? The very next minute, he ends up with Charlotte, who is clearly the very best person for him, the very best person in the whole story for him, comes to him. Of course, he was not very perfect in his consciousness, but at least he accepted with a resignation, let me not resent the fact, let me forget it and go on with my life. And when he went on, immediately the thing around the corner presented itself, literally the next day. So, in summary of my answer to a very good question, we should do what's right. What's right is not an external thing. what's right is a question of consciousness. For Mr. Bennett, doing what's right is not a question, should I send Lydia to Brighton or should I send her to London or should I keep her here? What's right is I should not do something out of irresponsibility. I should not do something just because it's convenient for me. I should not do something out of laziness. I should not do something ignoring all the knowledge I have about Lydia. You don't need to have a vision. You don't need to know that there are men at Brighton who might want to elope with her or Wickham's a scoundrel in order to know that what you're doing is wrong. You only have to he only has to examine his own motives and know his motive is wrong. If his motive is wrong, it cannot possibly lead to the best consequence. The best consequence never comes out of the wrong motive. The right motive will always bring the best consequence sooner or later. Wonderful question. Any other question? Okay. Enough for us all to think about for Rapa's birthday, I think. Have a great day.
First, I am thanking Mr. Gary on behalf of all the senders and all the devotees. இப்போ ரெண்டு மாசமா இந்த சாப்டர் வந்து ரொம்ப தெளிவா நமக்கு ப்ரைட் அண்ட் ப்ரெஜிடிஸ் எக்ஸாம்பிளோடும் லைஃப் எக்ஸாம்பிளோடும் அவர் விவரித்து நிறைய சொல்லியிருக்கார். நமக்கு இது அப்பா நிறைய இடத்துல எக்ஸ்பிளனேஷனோட அப்பா நான் அப்பாவோட புக்ஸ்ல எழுதியிருக்கார். இதை ரெண்டு மாசமா நம்ம கேட்டதோட இந்த சாப்டர் முடியல. இப்பதான் வி ஹாவ் டு ஸ்டார்ட் வித் திஸ் சாப்டர். அதுதான் நம்மளுக்கு நாம இந்த சாப்டர் ரெண்டு மாசமா கேட்கறதோட இது என்னன்னா, we have to implement and where we have to accept and implement and adapt and the life response namba kondu varudhu dhaan indha chapter namba kettadhukku nandiyargalaga irukkum endru ninaikiren. anbargal anaivarukkum nandi vanakkam kuri vidai perugiren.